Hey, everybody, welcome to the Daily Friend, the podcast. That's right, the Daily Friend podcast. It comes to you every Friday, and it is a product of the Institute of Race Relations and, of course, the Big Liberty Show. That's right, I'm your host, Big Daddy Liberty, and we're going to have a very interesting conversation today. It's going to be mostly an international conversation, looking at things that have made the news around the world, things that we think you should know about, because at the end of the day, they'll have an impact on you, the Daily Friend listener. Remember, you can also read our news, analysis, and opinion on the Daily Friend website. That's dailyfriend.co.za. Great articles there by a myriad of voices, and actually awesome analysts who are producing quality content for you guys. Here's a bit of a lowdown and juicy tidbit for you. I would look out for the Daily Friend going forward, because we're about to introduce a very interesting character, one who I know you guys will like. A very big announcement is coming on Sunday from the IRR and the Daily Friend. So stay tuned for that. Trust me, it will be worth it. Stay tuned. It'll likely break the news and break the internet over the weekend. Guys, as I said, my name is Big Daddy Liberty, and I'm not alone in here. I have two colleagues of mine, very eclectic mix and very interesting chaps who I think you guys should get used to. I'm going to introduce them one by one. I'm going to start with our new face here at the IRR. His name is Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
I am excellent. Thank you, CJ.
Excellento. Herman, of course, is a new acquisition here, very smart chap who's going to be writing for us, and he is a writer and analyst here at the IRR. We also have a mainstay of the channel, and one half of the Two Crickets in a Thorn Bush Thorn Tree show, Mr. Nicholas Lorimer. Nicholas, how are you doing, chap?
I'm doing very well today, CJ.
Excellento, brother. Fellas, let's get into it. There's four issues I think we're going to touch on today. And as I said, the show will have a bit of an international flavor to it. Let's begin on the more interesting stuff, the more colorful character, excuse the pun, a one Boris Johnson. Now, we spoke about him on the Wednesday edition of the Daily Friend, the televised edition, that is, which you can find, of course, on the Daily Friend website, dailyfriend.co.za. Boris Johnson, new prime minister, makes his maiden speech. What do we think about the speech? Was it the good bang opener?
Well, I think it certainly was. He quite clearly made a decision to be energetic, to list in detail, actually, the things he wanted to accomplish. And that's, incidentally, one of the things that Johnson has been criticized for in the past, being short on detail. And his maiden speech in the House of Commons, he gave us quite some detail, I think as much detail as could realistically be expected. And this, of course, was an echoing of the detail he gave in his speech on the steps of Downing Street. So I thought it was a good speech. The reception he got from his own party was quite positive. And I know, I think there's definitely a change of tone and a change of character.
Nick, your thoughts on his opening speech, the snippets that we saw?
I think it's going to be great. He really hammered Corbyn in a nice way, which was really refreshing to watch. Both Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn are not, you know, towers of charisma. And so watching, you know, kind of energetic, excitable, erudite Boris hammering Corbyn. I don't know how long he's going to be prime minister for, but for the time being, I think it's going to be quite a glorious experience.
Now, chaps, this is a very colourful character, and we were making the point on the show that there has been this almost lazy criticism, almost knee-jerk criticism of the guy. You know, the moment people realise that, okay, it's going to be Boris Johnson, then you got the sort of usual banal comparisons to Donald Trump, and, oh, you know, he's an alt-right figure, fascists are, I mean, I'm actually quoting stuff that I've seen, right? Yeah. Oh, fascists are on the rise, blah, blah, blah. But can he really be compared to Donald Trump?
Well, in the sense that they both have legs, and they are both politicians and wonderful. That's about as far as... Well, to be completely frank, there are some comparisons that are legitimate. They are both, I think, quite maverick in terms of being politicians. They are both challenges to the, you know, reigning status quo of politician. But, I mean, in that way...
I mean, are they... Boris Johnson has been around for a long time in the Tory party.
But I think, perceptionally, the voter sees them as good. Where's the China shop? We've got a bull. But the problem is, Margaret Thatcher was also that. Mandela was also that in a way. You know, a challenge to the perceived status quo. So in that regard, yeah, some mavericky parallels. But in truth, Boris Johnson is a liberal in the sense of the word. He is incredibly pro-immigration, pro-free markets. And
pro-free trade.
And pro-free trade. So I think the comparisons, as you say, Sithle, they are lazy, and I think there are cheap political points scored by people who really, really won't bother with deeper analysis.
There's another point, I think, as well, where they are actually similar, which is they're both, I would call, character politicians. That is, they have a very defined public image authentic. As to what they're like, and they're also very specific kind of national stereotypes, right? You can't imagine a Donald Trump coming from any country except the United States. He's very much a creature of New York. Yeah. That's what he is. He doesn't. He wouldn't fit anywhere else. He wouldn't
perhaps
play
Australia
to any other.
A bit, but I
maybe
see what you're
maybe
saying.
At a stretch. But I think he's very much a kind of an American type of character.
Mm.
In the same way, Boris Johnson is exactly the same. He's a very, very British politician.
No,
his personality, his image is all wrapped up in this kind of Eton, referencing the classics, being slightly a bit rubbish. You know that very the English love that.
Self-deprecation.
I mean, if you watch him campaigning, he'll say things like, "Would you mind terribly perhaps voting for me?"
There was a wonderful story I read about someone telling their Boris Johnson experience about how they were in the early 2000s, they were on the after dinner circuit speaking kind of
thing. I've read the story
in,
as well.
In London, and the first time he bumped into Boris, it was like minutes before Boris had to go on for his speech, and he showed up and he was all tousle-haired and, you know, just a bit all over the place. And he was like, "Oh, yes, well, what are we talking about? What's the occasion?
Doing this very obvious thing where he said, "And that gives me great pleasure to be at the," and then very obviously squinting at the
sign,
at the banner, yes, of the event he was at.
Pediatricians,
yes.
And then this guy said, "Oh, this was wonderful." On such a impromptu level, this guy is an entertainer, and he had the audience in the palm of his hand. And then a year later, the same thing happened where they were both booked to speak at the same corporate event, and Johnson did exactly the same spiel.
That reminds me actually of one of my favorite moments of Donald Trump is when he was talking about the deal they had just signed, or the non-deal they had just signed with North Korea, where he said something along the lines of, "They might stick to it, they might not. And you know me, I'll probably say that they're sticking to it even if they don't." He said something very similar to that, which to me was a very a clear expression that Donald Trump knows he's playing the character Donald Trump. And every now and again, his best moments are actually when he has this sort of self-awareness, and he often makes a joke about it.
Yeah, and the thing is that I think is the main difference between the kind of Trump character and the Johnson character is Trump, I don't think, is as calculating as Johnson. He has a feel for strategic communication and stuff like that. But Johnson has that feel, but also is incredibly, I think, planned in his chaos, planned in his spontaneity. He creates this idea that I'm unpredictable and you don't know what's going to come out of my mouth. But actually, he's quite careful as a politician.
Let me bring something up here. And as we sort of continue down this line of thought, let's look at his maiden speech too. You guys made some very brilliant points on the show where you're saying, look, here's a guy who's basically speaking to a new broom sweeping in British government, number one. Number two, hinted at some reforms.
Yeah.
And number three, and I'll let Herman begin on this one, Has kind of actually ushered in some new faces, in a sense.
Yes.
New faces. Let me stick with that. So let's maybe zoom in the conversation on that, right? So his maiden speech, some of the reforms he spoke to, and the cabinet picks that he's made already.
Yeah, certainly. When a British Prime Minister or an Australian Prime Minister or Prime Minister comes in, there's always this window of opportunity where you can establish your brand, where you can establish the momentum of your administration. And I think Johnson has strategically grasped that as with all hands he could possibly muster. And in so doing, he has created this narrative of energy, this narrative of let's go get this change, let's have some chutzpah, some gusto, and the world's our oyster, the British lion can roar again. And part of that is the cabinet he assembled. The cabinet is a very young cabinet, incidentally. I think the oldest guy is the Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox, who is 59 or something. And you've got a whole bunch of, not perhaps new faces, they've been in cabinet before, but they are now in senior positions where they were in junior positions before. People like Dominic Raab, people like Saeed Javid. Well, he was in a senior position previously, but he's a young, talented guy. And people like Priti Patel. So this new cabinet that he has put in office really is, as you say, a change cabinet. It is a break from the past. It is going back to a sort of conservatism that we last saw really during the Thatcher years.
It's also, I think, if you were going to actually be serious about doing Brexit, this is probably the cabinet you would pick.
Yeah. Because it's basically the Leave campaign. It's basically the bright stars of the Leave campaign.
And we made this point on Wednesday to say the Brits found themselves almost having someone at the helm, i.e. Theresa May, who was a Remainer. Of course they'd have, you know, the internal contradictions and the toing and froing. Chaps, I'm going to put this question to you. Short answer, will we see a concerted push for a Brexit? And what are the scenarios we're likely to see pop from this under a Johnson administration?
Well, I think there's definitely going to be a push because Johnson's future depends on it. If he fails at this, he fails as Prime Minister and he probably won't make a year. Yes. If he succeeds at this, his political stock may go very well up and he might be the hero of the Tory party. But
yeah, no, that's undoubtedly the case. The thing about the Brexit scenario or the Brexit saga is it doesn't really have a beautiful end each faction, each party is so married and so devoted to their position that somewhere someone's going to be disappointed, and the stakes are therefore incredibly high. And for Johnson, the stakes are exactly as Nick sets out. If he fails to deliver Brexit, he will be, you know, possibly the shortest serving prime minister for about 100 or more years. I'm not exactly sure, but he has to push for Brexit. If he fails in this, he fails in toto. And I think one of the things you mentioned, Theresa May, one of the problems with the May premiership was that she spent about a year and a half trying to convince people of her Brexit bona fides. She tried to say Brexit means Brexit, no deal is better than a bad deal. She really tried to recast herself as someone with the necessary spine to go for Brexit in the, you know, full
very much take on the Thatcherite mantle.
Yes. This just saying no to Europe, being the champion of Britain in Europe. And by that, she lost time. She lost precious, precious time. And Boris is in a slightly better position. He doesn't have to convince people of his Brexit bona fides.
But not only that, she annoyed everyone. She had no allies. She tried to keep riding the fence between the sort of Remainer and Leave factions. Mm. And it left her with almost no support.
Yeah, it's like the Thatcher quote, if you're going to stand in the middle of the road, you're going to get hit by traffic from both sides. Yeah. And she was absolutely flattened. And the historic losses she endured in Parliament for her Brexit plans, I mean, speak for themselves.
Okay, so we have a bit of direction by the sounds of it, and whether real or perceived, a real sense of momentum and energy that comes with Boris. But I think the ordinary South African listening to the show now is probably thinking, yeah, but guys, you know, we've been having this Brexit conversation for 3 or 4 years now. Yeah? Talk to us about what are the options available to Boris in terms of the types of Brexit? Because that was the sticking point, wasn't it,
to
an extent?
Yes.
Herman, I'm going to look to you to this one. Mm. The I think you've sort of spoken to me before about this, the two or three options really available.
Yes.
And how will Brussels respond?
Right. So for the Centre of Risk Analysis is a strategic intelligence report, which you can get if you sign up as a client for the CRA. We advise corporate clients, governments, all banks, you know, these large entities, advise them on the risks they may be facing. So if you want access to that kind of information, do become a client. The analysis I did on the Brexit situation for the CRA, I identified six possible options, and only six. There isn't a seventh. In terms that it's either the revocation of Article 50, the extension of Article 50, a no-deal Brexit, a renegotiation of the existing withdrawal agreement, a general election, and now forgotten the sixth one. Can't exactly remember, but the real possibilities we might be looking at is a renegotiated withdrawal agreement, a general election, or a no-deal Brexit. Now, Johnson has made it clear that he's pushing for a deal, but he's going to ramp up no-deal preparations so that the UK will be ready to go out of the EU on the 31st of October.
Which is such an obvious step. It's insane to me that people haven't been doing this beforehand. Absolutely. If you can't walk away from the table, you can't make a deal that is anything less than capitulation.
You have no leverage if you're not willing to walk away. And I remember reading at the very beginning of the EU negotiation period, someone saying that what Britain should do now is tell the EU, we're going to go for no deal, we're going to prepare for no deal, make us an offer we can't refuse. And I mean, that would have been the smart thing to do. It's playing the game of negotiations. So
you'd think that politicians, the British Parliament, or at least everyone who is at least in favor of some sort of Brexit, would realize that as politicians they should be lying, right? Because all they needed to do was lie and say, "Oh, we're fully going for no deal, and that's all we're interested in," and then the EU would have been forced to take them more seriously. But instead, they kept reading the stage directions and saying, "No, but we can't actually go through no deal."
Yes, and that's where we are now. I think that's what the Boris narrative that he's trying to create is we are willing to do this. We are willing to go at it alone, and if we have to, we must. So, talking about what will Brussels' reaction be? Now, let's be completely honest. The EU does not want no deal. The German economy yesterday saw their manufacturing sector doing horribly on the latest data. The EU, the Eurozone economy is incredibly fragile. It is largely based around that of the German economy, and if the German economy isn't doing well, then the Eurozone will suffer. So a no-deal Brexit.
It also doesn't want to hurt the Irish.
Yes, it doesn't want to hurt the Irish. So the EU really, really, or the EU 27, the remaining EU countries without the United Kingdom, they really, really don't want no deal. But at this point, they are also saying that the withdrawal agreement is done, dusted, no new negotiations. Those two things can't be true at the same time. They don't want a deal. They don't want no deal. No one wants no deal because there's, I think, disproportionate fear to what it will do. But there is this fear among politicians. However, when you look at what can be done to get a deal, the EU are saying they won't budge, but they will budge. I am willing to, you know, put the few rands I have on the table to say that they will have to budge. Otherwise, they will incur no deal. And the thing is, there are readily apparent concessions they can make to get a deal through the House of Commons.
But of course, the EU hasn't negotiated much better because even though they also don't want no deal, they haven't been telling everyone that they're terrified of it and they're going to do everything to prevent it. They've argued quite strongly. They've had a coherent plan, I think, for the most part, and their negotiations have been far more successful than what the British have done.
Yeah, because it's almost like the British haven't tried to negotiate, really. The main thing, the main lever, or the main card the British have to play is the financial settlement, the 40 or so billion pounds or billion euros that the EU desperately needs, otherwise they are practically bankrupt, so for the next financial framework at least. So Britain has the money. The EU has the concessions it can make. And up to this point, these two things haven't been measured off against each other to get the best deal for both sides. And I think if I could list four points of concession that we might see from the EU to Britain to get this deal passed. Firstly, a time limit on the Irish backstop, so that the not the Irish backstop, the UK-wide backstop, so that the UK isn't trapped in kind of this orbit around the EU.
Just for the sake of the listeners, what do you mean by a Irish backstop? What does that mean?
Right. So this might be a bit pernickety in detail, but I'll try to make it as succinct as possible. The United Kingdom consists of Northern Ireland, Wales, Scotland, and England. Northern Ireland is one half of what was previously Ireland. However, Ireland is now two countries. You've got the Republic of Ireland to the south, and then you've got Northern Ireland to the north. Northern Ireland being part of the UK, the Republic of Ireland not being part of the UK. However, you've got the Belfast or the Good Friday Agreement, which basically created the separation, ensconced it, and created the Irish peace between the separatists and the unionists. And part of that agreement is that the two islands, as it were, Northern and the Republic, will have an open border, will have frictionless trade. They won't be this imposition of Ireland actually breaking up into two areas, just two national jurisdictions.
There's also, I think, shared citizenship in a way. Not quite, but you can take citizenship of
yes, it's a very unique arrangement due to the unique circumstances of Ireland. But the problem faced now is, with Brexit, you have Northern Ireland, part of the UK, leaving the European Union, and you have the Republic of Ireland remaining in the European Union. So that is the point where there's a land border between the UK and the EU. But it's not just any land border. It's a land border that is dependent on the Belfast Agreement that sets these strict conditions of they will be so they will try to minimize friction between the two islands. So the backstop, the Irish backstop, was an original proposal by the EU to say, right, if we can't negotiate a new trading agreement between the UK and the EU, there will be this kind of fallback option that Northern Ireland will be treated separately as part of the island of Ireland as a whole. So there will be this this special status for Northern Ireland where it is treated differently to the rest of the UK. That, however, is very much in conflict with the United Kingdom and the Belfast Agreement because Northern Ireland very much wants to be treated as part of the UK.
Or at least the unionists do.
So you've got the situation.
What was it their leadership said? We're not going to let the EU do to us what we've been fighting for years.
Yes. Yes, and that's the DUP, and then I absolutely support that. So you've got the situation where they don't want the Irish backstop. So then the Irish backstop was changed to a UK-wide backstop in a sense that the whole UK will now be in this kind of orbit around the European Union if a trade deal isn't arrived at. And that's the problem because there's no exit mechanism. People have made the point that the UK can withdraw from NATO. They can withdraw from the United Nations. They can withdraw from the European Union, but they can't withdraw from the backstop arrangement. Mm. And that's a big problem. Even the Attorney General, still in office, under Boris Johnson, under Theresa May, said that from a legal perspective, there is no unilateral right of exit for the UK out of the backstop. If they're in that backstop, the only way they can get out of it is if the EU lets them. And that's a big problem. So that's a big, big, big problem. So that's a backstop issue. If we can get something like a time limit from the EU saying that the backstop will only extend for 2 years or 3 years or 5 years, that'll be a step towards getting this deal through. Then the other two things that they might look at, the one thing is kind of a sub-point, the electronic monitoring of the border between the two islands, which is supposed to be unicorn technology, but the EU themselves have suggested similar things, so that gives us reason to hope for concession. And then the other last 2 points is a revision of the role of the European Court of Justice in the interpretation of the treaty, and then the last thing is, of course, to suspend the payment of the financial settlement until a trade deal is reached. Those are the obvious four spaces for concession, and I really can see movement on those 4 points.
All right, chaps, we're going to move on slightly. I think we've exhausted this issue, and now it's almost wait-and-see game, right? It's the ball's quite firmly in Boris's hand, in this regard. immigration. That is emigration, so that people leaving this country. We had a full-on chat on the show, and we were making the point, because it's something I've been tweeting about, you know, in the week, and the tweet's gone a little bit sort of viral-ish. You know, I asked two questions, and I premised the questions as follows. You know, you now have a situation where South Africa is firmly on the path to a almost socialist dystopia if the ANC and its National Democratic Revolution were to have its way. And let's assume for a moment a EFF under Julius Malema wins the election. You know, it's their stated goal, essentially, a socialist dystopia, especially if you look at the is it seven cardinal sins? Cardinal pillars of the EFF. South Africans are clearly not having this. They, especially the more skilled ones, the middle class, and they're looking to leave for this and many other reasons, by the way, from crime to the high poverty rates, et cetera, et cetera. So here's the question I posed. Fellas, do you know someone or do you know people who have left the country? Give me a number. And as you're giving me a number, what were the sort of skill sets that they left with? Because that speaks to a ever increasingly, or rather ever shrinking, tax base in this country, and just no money to do anything, let alone a socialist, fund a socialist dystopia.
Well, amongst my fairly young group of friends, this evening actually, I'm going to a farewell for a friend who's moving to Germany. Now that he's an opera singer. So that's not a
what a great employment career.
that's not a super vital one, but that's a kind of an example of what's going on. Every single one of my friends has a plan to leave the country in the next, you know, sort of 10 years. And they range in skills from there's one's a video editor. One of them is a computer programmer. One of them is into financial services and insurance, and he's very successful entrepreneurial guy. And he's almost certainly going to move to the UK within the next 5 years.
Mm. If we can go to, you know, opera singers moving overseas, then basically all of the people I studied opera with are going overseas. But I think that, that crowd, but I think it would be unfair to count them because opera just isn't a thing in South Africa. But many of them are going for opera, but also for the quality of life.
But I think everyone knows or has heard stories of, you know, for example, the traditional skills that kind of built South Africa. So sort of mining, metal work, engineering, those kind of things. Those people especially seem to be going overseas.
When we were chatting earlier, I said that my a lot of my family now, my people who are accountants and academics and software, computer scientists, these people, I mean, my brother is already in Ireland before he... just for the quality of life there. So, and we're not a family that have ever really doubted our place in South Africa. And this has, in the past 2 years, really, really ramped up for us that we are actually... I mean, I've looked at house prices for my parents in other African countries. Not that I'm going to buy them a house. Sorry, Mum and Dad. But in the sense that we... are actually, it's no longer just, oh, you know, South Africa is, you know, oh, going through deep waters. It's like this is a ship that might be sinking and we might have to jump. And that's a new thing in our family.
I know my family is exactly the same. The other thing I think that people are doing, a lot of younger people particularly, and this is very cross-racial, is going off to teach English in Asia in particular. Mm. So I know people who've gone off to teach English
I know a few.
In South Korea, and moved there permanently after establishing themselves there. Some who've gone to Japan, some have gone to China, although China's not so friendly about letting you stay after you've finished your work. Some to Vietnam. One of my friends who I grew up with is actually in Vietnam currently. Apparently, he transitioned from teaching to opening a school there.
And this, you guys raise some interesting stuff here, because this bursts the myth that somehow it's just the highly skilled, middle-aged white South Africans who are leaving. Absolutely not.
With their wealth, taking their wealth with them.
I have friends who are in that exact same boat, you know. Guys who say, listen, I've just got my degree. In fact, let me take a step back. When I finished university back in 2008, you know, we had guys who were saying, listen, I don't necessarily have the best of degrees. You know, I've got a BA in linguistics or something like that. And please don't at me, people who have BAs in linguistics. But, you know, they saw themselves as not having opportunities here. They left. You have guys who did nursing. I have an aunt who's been in the Middle East, or rather in the Arab world, for going on 18 years now, right? These are not like your... you know, neurosurgeon type skills. These are almost entry level or very basic type skills, but people are leaving.
Two of my music teachers at school went to teach in Dubai. So that's not a job you usually think, oh, that's got
a scarce
world
skill.
Reach.
No. So the question I'll pose is this one. And there's data, by the way, that is showing that more Black South Africans are also part of the exodus. It's not a racial thing. How sustainable is this? Because you now have, and there's been two responses to my tweets online. You basically have those who obviously, you know, call and response. So they've said, look, I know X amount of people. These are the skill sets. Then you have this gnashing of teeth. I call them the quote unquote, let them leave brigade, who take on this very spiteful tone of, you people, you know, you're not part of the South African experiment. You're copping out. I heard one of the DA people say, and I sort of look at these people and I go, but you don't understand the
struggles.
The circumstances of a lot of these people. A lot of these people have kids and they're thinking, they're looking at the state of the country and they're saying, I'm not sure I can be a parent in South Africa where I need to pay for and worry about the safety of these children and the education of these children. But here's my question. Talk to me for a moment around how the Let Them Leave Brigade seriously think they're going to be able to afford their trendy lefty dystopia if the very people that you tax to achieve this are leaving your country and are becoming taxpayers overseas?
A while ago, Sihle, I was on your show for the first time, and I mentioned, and I'm going to mention it again, the example of Uganda. In 1971, 1972, when Idi Amin kicked out the Asians out of Uganda. And the Asians were very much your middle-class, business-owning, property-owning citizens, and they were given how many days? 40 or something days, a few days, even less perhaps, I can't remember, to get out of the country. And then they went. And then two stories develop. You can look at what happened to the Ugandan economy when that happened, and you can look at what happened to these families that left. The Ugandan economy absolutely collapsed. It lost wealth generators. It lost employers. It lost a large part of the backbone of its, you know, small and medium enterprise economy. And then you look at what these families did. They went to Canada, they went to the UK, they went to Australia, and within a decade, they went from being poor immigrants having just arrived, having left their wealth, left their businesses, left their homes. Within a decade, they were back to being middle class. So this isn't an issue about, you know, oh, you're quitting. It's we are unwelcome here. Whether we are made unwelcome by the government or whether we are made unwelcome by government policy, forcing significant doubt over the future of our children, we don't want to be here. We need to make better plans. And if you're going to be part of the cop-out brigade, I have two things to say to you. First, humanity has reached its current, you know, points of inhabitants purely because people have picked up and gone off in search of better shores. South Africa is populated because black tribes from the Congo area moved down for reasons of social, socioeconomic, political, military reasons. So there's no such thing as copping out. To move to another country for the betterment of circumstance is literally the defining feature of modern man.
As for how they think that we can sort of afford things without, without these skills, the myths that the sort of woke Let Them Leave Brigade, their entire ideology is built on, are essentially a kind of a conspiracy theory. They believe that the all the wealth of the country is basically hidden away by whites, that whites are basically just parasites.
That there's a finite amount of wealth.
Yeah, that there's a very finite amount of wealth, that there's that whites are essentially kind of just a sort of parasite, that their skills don't really help, and that simply if we eject these thieves and these controllers of the economy, there will be this release of the sort of natural wealth of the country will just flow out to the masses. So they kind of almost view... white people in particular, but kind of anyone who really doesn't get on board with the program as these dams holding back.
Which is an increasing number of black and Asian South Africans.
Holding back the prosperity of the country. And if they are... and they also don't really think that we're running out of money. They'll always say things like, if you kind of ask this question to the more clued up ones, they'll say, oh no, but corporate South Africa has all this money we can just take.
No.
And once we can take it, then we can pay for everything that we want.
There's been, as I said earlier as well, there's been a 45 billion rand equity net outflow in 2019 up to now. The money's going. The money is leaving. Investor confidence is not where it should be.
Also, when you start to do the maths, the money doesn't go that far.
Yeah.
I mean, this you see this debate often in the inequality stuff that goes on in the US. But if you really kind of begin to plumb into things, you begin to realize that to give people decent amounts of cash to do anything with, to live off or something, you actually will very quickly run out of things, especially if that wealth isn't being generated to replace things.
I spoke to a Zimbabwean gentleman the other day who told me that the Zimbabwean diaspora that fled the country within the last 2-3 decades are basically the brain wealth, the cognitive wealth, or a large part of that, of the Zimbabwean population. And many of these people are waiting to get back to Zimbabwe. They are literally doctors, teachers, nurses, engineers, who want to go back to the country, but they cannot see themselves there because the circumstances won't support a prosperous existence for them or their kids. And I think we might see a similar thing with South Africa. Is these people... The moment things change in this country, I think there will be a reversal of this trend. South Africans will come home because there's nothing a refugee, for whatever reason, wants more than to go back to their home.
Absolutely. And let's speak to that as we maybe cap off this point. What would need to happen to see South Africans come back? Number one, I think, top of the list, if anything, is we must get a handle on the crime situation.
Yeah,
you cannot have a property-owning, prosperous and vibrant society if people cannot even leave their homes for fear of some form of violation of their life, their liberty, or their property. What else should we be doing? Nick, what needs to happen if we're to attract these people back here? Because really, we live in a competitive world where the skilled individual can be anywhere they want to be, really.
Well, you know, we have a lot of socioeconomic problems that are not going to be sorted out very quickly. But I think the first things we can do is get economic growth back. Because if people have opportunities and can make a lot of money, they will put up with a lot of garbage. If you did, for example, if you freed up the private sector to provide education so that people didn't have to rely on the state system, and the same with healthcare, you could attract migrants back to a growing economy because they'd be able to put their kids in private schools and go use private healthcare. So while you build up state capacity, you can then have these kind of middle-class people coming in and paying the taxes. But crucial to getting that economic growth going, you have to do the basics, the stuff we always go on about. The first is reforming the labor laws so that unions are not as powerful as they are now, that it's easier to fire people, and that consequently it will then be easier to hire people and less risky to do so.
Yes.
You also need to kind of break away a lot of regulations so that companies can actually turn a profit more easily without having to pay up, and so that newer entrants can enter the market. If you had a much more open, free environment, you would have a lot of smaller competitors entering the market. I think it was our chief economist, Ian Cruickshank, said recently that since the 90s, the number of companies on the JSE has gone down by it's halved.
It's
gone from about 600 to 300.
Yeah,
so that's because when you have a kind of very tight stranglehold of the economy by the state, people often think, oh, you know, when you have a regulation, corporations don't like that. No, the big guys like that because it allows them to keep out
the
smaller players. Yes, so we've had this almost consolidation of industries. In fact, monopoly capital, as our friends in the EFF like to talk about, has been strengthened by the overpowering role of the state. So if you want these people back, you need to have these opportunities for little guys to enter the market, and also alternatives so that they can buy their own private security, buy their own private healthcare, and buy their and buy education for their kids. And if they can do that, they will start paying taxes, and you can use that to build up state capacity so that you can start servicing the poor with the state better.
Yeah, and to add two minor points to that, because I mean Nick, you basically said it. That's what needs to happen. Is there needs to be a culture of incentivizing work. Currently, if we look at the social grants rollout system a few years ago, we could, as a country, afford it because we were paying down our debts, that we were paying down our state debt. So the savings we made on not paying the interest of those debts was enough to roll out the social grant system. However, the proportion of people to work and people on social grants has reversed effectively since the institutionalization of the system or since the start of that system. And we need to get a way to reverse that trend again. Work must be incentivized. And that is absolutely, absolutely vital that we address that system, because I don't think anyone in South Africa would really strongly argue for the absolute one day to the next stopping of the social grant system. I think that would be cruel, and I don't think anyone really wants that to happen. But we must start looking at options to, if not phase out social grants, to phase in work incentives with those social grants.
So if you listen to our friends on the sort of statist side, socialist side, they'll talk about just getting more money out of the private sector to pay for everything and to cover all these costs and to avoid these downfalls that you're sort of talking about. But one of the things that they often don't talk about is that the gutting of state capacity, particularly in such a things such as SARS, has actually made it so that even if you really could, even if all the money was there to be taken, even if there was enough, the state isn't capable of taking all of that money right now. And I'm sure we don't know entirely what the level of tax avoidance in the country is, but I'm sure it's fairly significant. And it's probably going to grow as state capacity weakens. The return on investment for squeezing companies gets lower and lower and lower, not just to the sort of diminishing returns of preventing them from growing, but also from the fact that as the state becomes weaker and more dysfunctional and more bloated, it's easier to hide from the taxman.
If we're going to be talking to our Red Beret friends and we want to have, we agree with them that we want rich people into South Africa to keep their money here to fund South Africa's growth. Yes, you don't do that by forcing them to keep their money here, because they can afford getting around the restrictions you will put on them. You get rich South Africans to keep their money in this country, making capital available to banks by incentivizing them to keep their money here, by having a tax structure which benefits you if you invest locally, not which punishes you if you invest elsewhere. So we all agree, let's keep South African money in South Africa. But it's just, do we do it by the force of gun, or do we do it by saying, you know, there's freedom here, there's opportunities here, it's better for you to invest your money here rather than overseas?
Okay, chaps, lively conversation, and you can see the other bits of it on the Daily Friend show. And I'm sure there's one of us will be writing on this on the Daily Friend website. Just a reminder, dailyfriend.co.za is where you get all of this content. Okay, guys, two more issues as we look to wrap up our conversation. And we're going international again, this time to America. Robert Mueller, the famous or infamous, I don't know how to characterize him, Robert Mueller, who had been investigating a one Donald Trump and allegations of Russian collusion, or that specifically he colluded with the Russians to win the election, appears before Congress, and it's a bit of a damp squib. Talk us through this, Nick.
So just to recap, the Mueller report basically said that Donald Trump had acted very not favorably. It put him in a very bad light. He kept trying to. He would keep mentioning to staff that they need to fire Mueller and stop the thing. There seems like there may have been an intention, perhaps, to obstruct justice. But it could find no evidence that the Trump campaign, despite an apparent willingness to do so, had actually done any sort of collusion with the Russians. There was all just a lot of talk. In fact, the closest thing to collusion with the Russians that had probably happened was when Donald Trump sort of half jokingly, half not, said, Russia, if you're out there, release the rest of Hillary's emails. Right, that was about the closest that came. The secret meeting and stuff that was talked about in the media between the Trump campaign and the Russians was really, it didn't amount to much. And as a result, there was no underlying crime in the Mueller report. And so this entire thing has now become a very kind of technical argument about whether Trump's actions and his administration's actions justified an obstruction of justice charge. And there was a fairly ridiculous standard put forward in the Mueller report where they concluded, we can't find evidence that the president hasn't committed a crime, which is completely contrary to the
presumption, again, of innocence.
Presumption of innocence, right? You don't start an investigation to determine whether someone is innocent.
Yeah.
It's to determine whether someone is guilty.
Yeah.
So this report comes out. Very few people read it. A lot of people kind of just draw the conclusions that they were going to draw anyway. A half of America says it completely exonerates him. The other half says that it damns him and that he's a criminal, basically. And the only reason he hasn't been charged is because it's difficult to charge a sitting president. But then what happens is the Democrats kind of don't want to let this go because as a political commentator in the U.S., Eric Erickson, who's a conservative talk show host, said that the Democrats have become obsessed with the silver bullet, which is what the Republicans did under Obama. They kept looking for, if we can find this one thing, we can just get rid of him as a president, and then we don't have to win an election against him. The Democrats have done the same thing with Trump. And this has driven them completely insane. They've followed down this road of impeachment, even as it became clear that despite Mueller bringing charges against Russian nationals for the most part, and Trump's former some of his former campaign staff for various irregularities, there was no real evidence of collusion. The case for impeachment is very weak now. And so they called Robert Mueller out to Congress to testify, even though he had said that, please don't call me, in a press conference a while ago, to see if they could get anything more out of him to build this case for impeachment. And it turned out that he basically, for the most part, just said, read the report. I mentioned this in the report, and I don't remember. So really, it didn't amount to much. And I think that it killed the last hope of any sort of realistic claim that they can impeach Trump. The most important part of the whole hearing was when someone asked him, did you not charge Trump with obstruction of justice because he was a sitting president? And Robert Mueller said something like, yes, that's kind of right. And then halfway through, he said, no, actually, I you misunderstood me. I wouldn't have charged him. Which is what killed the last hopes of perhaps building a proper impeachment case against Trump.
Yeah, no, the thing that people need to understand about impeachment is twofold. Firstly, you can impeach a sitting president for high crimes and misdemeanors. We haven't seen any evidence of high crimes or misdemeanors. We have seen evidence of, you know, douchebaggery and silliness and attempts to perhaps possibly try to have the intention of committing some misdemeanors, but the basis for impeachment isn't met constitutionally. The other thing is he might get impeached, but the impeachment won't be upheld by the Senate. How the impeachment process works is the House of Representatives votes to, whether or not to impeach the president. Then the matter goes to the Senate. That is what happened with Bill Clinton, and the impeachment wasn't upheld by the Senate. The Republicans control the Senate in any way, so they won't uphold impeachment for Donald Trump. But the thing that I think Nick mentioned that stands out to me in its entirety is the presumption of innocence is not some abstract, dusty legal concept that we have the luxury of caring about. It is the fundamental element, the foundation of modern law. Because if the presumption of innocence can be negated or compromised on for a president, it really, really, in theory, can apply to all Americans. You can then be considered, oh, we couldn't prove you didn't rape someone. We couldn't prove you didn't do A, B, or C. And therefore, the question remains unanswered. No, the question loses its validity the moment you cannot prove guilt. And that's the case here. I don't like Trump. I think he's an absolute buffoon. But even if I think the man's a buffoon, I can say there's no reason to find he had colluded with the Russians.
One of the big problems here has been this kind of confusion of impeachment with some sort of very legalistic process, as though it's a criminal trial.
Yeah.
It's not. It's a political process to see whether a person is fit to hold office or not. And the only people who can actually determine that is Congress, both the Senate and the House.
And they are such rational people.
And, yes. And if they decided, they you know, the president can, in a sense, be impeached for anything because it's such a subjective standard. The standard for impeachment is high crimes and misdemeanors,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah.
You know, anything he's done now in his presidency, Congress, if it decided to, could say, oh, that's a high crime against, you know, the state. Yeah.
And there's an important point here, maybe it's a last gasp, because, you know, guys, this thing has been dragging on since basically the beginning of this man's presidency. And you have Americans themselves, if you look at some of the latest polling and research, saying, you know, let's move on, man. 60% of Americans polled said after this Mueller appearance in Congress, like, guys, this is it's becoming a non-issue. Let's move on. Why? Because Trump, whether you like him or not, and to his credit, of the things that he promised he'll do, in all kudos to the guy, he's done them. I mean, the American economy right now is humming.
Yeah.
You know, it has more jobs than people actually.
Especially for black people and Hispanics, ironically.
Exactly. The very sort of minorities he was accused of being a bigot and a racist to are having a bumper time in terms of, you know, economic data.
I disagree a little bit there. He hasn't been nearly as successful on immigration as he promised to be. I mean, they said.
That's true.
Build the wall. The wall is not built yet.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's, and to be honest, thankfully, I'm not really a big fan necessarily of a wall. Insofar as I'm more a bigger fan of proper immigration system,
yeah,
which, you know, like any other country in the world, you know, prioritizes what the country needs.
And
skills
and treats the legal immigrant with exactly the same respect as the citizen.
Absolutely. So again, but that's not so much a Trump problem as it has been a obstruction by his opponents, you know, who don't even want to entertain a middle ground with this man.
In part, but he's also cut away opportunities he's had. So, for example, he was thinking about negotiating with the DACA agreement, which is this immigration proposal thing, which allows which exempts children of immigrants who were brought there as children, illegal immigrants, from
dreamers,
from
being so-called.
Yeah.
He's negotiated. For supposedly great negotiator, he hasn't negotiated really well on a lot of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I think he's undermined his own. He had a potential to get a number of wins when the Republicans were trying to repeal Obamacare.
Yeah.
He said, no, we can't be too cruel. We mustn't remove. He undermined the case the Republicans were making. And so there was a point where allegedly members of the House, Republican members of the House, before they lost the House in the midterms, were saying, we're not voting on anything until we see him tweet approval for it, which is a very dysfunctional way to run your legislative process.
Yeah.
And he's so vindictive against members of his own party who sort of he thinks are criticizing him. That he's kind of created this slight of this legislative incoherence. So, for example, Rand Paul has voted against some of his more important pieces of legislation. But Rand Paul in public praises Trump every opportunity he gets. And so he never gets any flack from Trump whatsoever. Whereas someone like, who is that guy? Mike Lee?
Yeah,
Mike Lee. Mike Lee criticized Trump very heavily, but voted more with his legislative agenda than Rand Paul did. Trump spends all of his energy attacking Mike Lee. This counterproductive stuff, I think, has made he's been moderately successful, but he hasn't been hugely successful due to this desire to stamp to get approval from his party rather than to push for legislative wins.
But I must say, in terms of Cecil's point, the number of promises he has actually kept or tried to keep is significant, especially, I think, with the two Supreme Court appointments, with the protection of free speech, with the defunding of, I think it's the Mexico City principle or something, the defunding of abortion as part of international foreign aid. He has kept a surprising amount of promises for someone so absolutely.
And he's done what he said he would do on trade war stuff.
No,
yes,
absolutely.
And he has done what he has said in terms of the economy. Regulations, they might not have started reversing, but they have certainly slowed down more than was expected.
Look, I mean, again, because people confuse an objective look at Trump as somehow someone supporting Trump. That's not the case. One need not support Trump to be objective, at least in saying, look, this guy basically made a whole bunch of promises, whether you like them or not, and he's kept a lot of them. Therefore, when you look at his base has remained strong.
In fact, I think it's strengthened.
Absolutely. If you look at his rallies, and for me, this is something which I think caught a lot of people off guard pre the election of Trump, where I used to say, often alone in circles, guys, this guy is going to win. No one packs an arena, a stadium like that, as if they're like Beyonce or Jay-Z, and somehow is not a contender. We're told Hillary will win with a landslide, if you remember that time.
98% chance.
And then you look at Hillary's sort of attendance at rallies, you know, just barely putting together old-age homes, you know, during lunchtime. And that's with the promise of tea and biscuits.
and the threat of violence.
You know, there's something to be said about this guy's pull. Is it a populist pull? Maybe. Is it maybe he's a charismatic guy and people just are drawn to that? Maybe. But here's the point I wanted to get to in terms of looking forward. And I want you guys to chip in on this one because it's an interesting, I look forward to your observations. Here's a guy who has a very strong base, and it comes out. Because in politics, that's the big trick, isn't it? It's bringing your base out or your supporters out on the day of an election and the like. What will be his election promises as a pitch for a second term? What does he say to this base? We've heard the sort of keep America great narrative, but what does that really mean? What does he need to do? And as you think about this, your biggest criticism of Donald Trump and his presidency?
I think his two strategies are this. He wants to fight the culture war, which is something that is very kind of difficult to pin down exactly what that means. But it means arguing about whether you should stand for the American national anthem at a football game. It means the Trump campaign has recently started selling plastic straws because they're saying that the Democrats are trying to ban straws and it's stupid and it doesn't make any sense. And, you know, all these little things that are actually not terribly important issues to people's lives.
But it's part of a narrative.
They're part of a larger narrative, and they're also part of people's identities. Mm. And if he can convince a very large group of Americans that they are under attack by the Democratic Party, that they have a very way of life, and that the Democratic Party are insane radicals.
And un-American.
And un-American. And that the only way to stop them is to vote for him. I think that's a big part of it. The other part is to just say the economy is doing very well and don't mess with what was it, the famous thing that Lincoln said, don't change horses in the middle of a stream. Don't mess with a good thing. And I think if he pushes those two, he might do very well. The problem with the culture war stuff is it can also motivate the Democratic base because they see him preventing transgender people being in the military, something like that, and they get very upset. They see him as a kind of proto-fascist ruler who's coming to crush their freedoms. So it's a very delicate act because he needs to motivate his own base, but at the same time not over-motivate the Democratic base because the Democratic base is larger. If you poll Americans, you'll find that there tend to be more Democrats than Republicans. And also if he isolates, then it becomes a fight for that middle independent group. Yeah, and the culture war stuff doesn't always work with them because they don't fit neatly into either category. He might win with that strategy, but it's a risky one.
I must say, I'm going to disagree with you on the independence and the culture war strategy. I think America, Americans like most South Africans, I think are moderate conservatives. Family is important, the flag is important, faith is important. And I saw Sisley getting attacked for saying that, but I must say I'm quite with him on that. And I think America has that strong strain of conservatism that that forms the basis of the culture war. And I think if you're going to look at the independents in America, they are much, much, much more likely to fall in the category of I don't want people with male genitalia to use the same bathroom as my 10-year-old daughter.
Final thoughts, guys? Your biggest criticism of the guy?
I mean, so I'm a sort of monstrous warmongering hawk. So I think that his foreign policy hasn't been very coherent. I think that his deal with North Korea was probably the low point. He keeps praising Kim Jong Un, which no one really takes too seriously, but it's a bit gross. The guy is probably the worst dictator on the planet.
Yeah.
And he talks about the beautiful letter that he got from Kim Jong Un, and the deal that he signed has not stopped the North Koreans. There was a lot of reporting that now they've stopped their weapons testing and stuff. They tested missiles. I think it was yesterday. Off the coast, short-range missiles, nothing nuclear. And as it turns out, the North Koreans have actually made no concessions whatsoever that they weren't willing to make already. So the Trump administration, I think, has not had a great foreign policy. It's been okay sometimes, but it's been a little bit incoherent because Trump can't decide whether he's the tough international takes no prisoners type of hawk guy, or whether he's the no foreign wars, no intervention, let's spend all of our money at home type of guy.
Yeah.
And that that incoherence has meant that they will be very aggressive on an issue and then suddenly they'll retreat.
Yeah.
So that was a good example that happened in the North Korea issue. He kind of
used. And in the Strait of Hormuz now, recently.
Yeah, in the Strait of Hormuz. His Iran strategy, I think, actually might work. He's playing a sort of very economic game, and I think that's probably better than a military one at this time. But it's going to need consistency and coherence. And so far, Trump has done many, many impressive things, but being consistent and coherent is not always what he's best at.
Yep. Mike, my criticism of Trump is more philosophical. He's the anti-Mandela. In a sense that Edmund Burke, the British philosopher, said that you have two functions of the Constitution, or you have two parts of the Constitution, the symbolism and the functionality. And the UK has it nicely. They have a symbolic head of state, the monarch, and then they have a functional head of government, the prime minister. Mandela was an excellent, excellent symbolic head of state. He wasn't a functionally good president. Trump is a functionally excellent president. Symbolically, he is absolutely a constitutional disaster.
And sorry about that. And maybe on that note, let's wrap it up. And I'll share just this one quick thing. My biggest criticism of Trump is the inability for him to actually be the sort of conservative America does need, which is the guy who actually looks at the debt problem that the Americans are facing.
Absolutely.
And challenges it head on, especially when you have a strong base like that. But yeah, well, time will tell, and we'll see what the Trump of the second, or looking for a second term, will be like, and who he'll be. Chaps, thank you very much. I was joined, of course, by Nicholas Lorimer, who is a writer and analyst here at the IRR, and of course our new face, Herman Pretorius, who is also a writer and analyst, and we welcome these chaps anytime on the I nearly said the Big Liberty Show, but on the Daily Friend. Guys, and we also welcome you. We welcome your support. We welcome your listening, your sharing, your liking of our material. We hope it is adding value to your day-to-day experience. Just a quick heads up, we will be changing the ordering of our shows as of next week. That is as of the 29th of July. Just look forward to that. You'll get more content, but more accessible content. So I'll let you guys know on Monday as to what that looks like. Just a quick reminder, please support our work. We are wholly dependent on you. You can do that by SMSing your name to 32823. The terms and conditions to apply. An SMS will cost you R1. And we're looking for you to contribute a R90 a month as a friend of the IRR. That is our crowdfunding campaign. You can also, if you don't like SMSs, do that by finding us online at irr.co.za. irr.org.za. /join, and you can sign up a monthly debit order there. Guys, thank you so much for listening to the Daily Frame podcast. We'll see you, or rather, you'll catch us next week.